So it was a pleasure to welcome Stephen De Silva back to the studio, who's given us many memorable accounts of things to do with the cathedral. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
The cathedral is moving forward in the sense that the visitor centre, which is after the new museum and gallery, the next exciting development. What's the schedule on that? I've seen that the scaffolding is still up.
We just laid the concrete floor on the new visitor centre. That's very exciting. The work inside the chapter house from 1980, that's been completed substantially. So now it's building the welcome centre to fit between the chapter house and the cathedral itself. The timetable is almost exactly a year away. We're talking in the last week of June in 2018, and on the 22nd of June 2019, which is St. Albans Day, which falls very nicely on a Saturday, we shall open the new welcome centre. So we're really excited. A year's countdown now to the great event.
I think it must be something to do with the faith that underlies the cathedral, that you're prepared to put a date.
Well, we think the building will be finished maybe a couple of months before then. That's the plan. That's what the builders tell us anyway. So, yes, we have faith that we're going forward with this. I mean, the whole thing has been that kind of faith project. I mean, look back 10 years and just, I don't know, any of us would have believed this was really happening.
Just talk me through the route. You would come in from Santillard, or can you come in anywhere to the visitor centre from any side?
You can enter the cathedral from the West End, you know, the grand entrance facing St. Albans School. But the truth is, and we've known this for 20 years now, that the vast majority of visitors come through Santillard. They'll either come down Waxhouse Gate or they'll come from Holywell Hill. And that's really why the Welcome Centre is being built there, because that's where we need to greet the majority of our visitors. So you'll walk down Santillard in a beautifully landscaped Santillard. We're just about to approve, we hope, the plans for the landscaping there. And be welcomed into this new visitor centre with all singing, all dancing facilities.
And it will be effectively tucked between the back of the chapter house and the south come east end of the cathedral.
Yes, the southeast wall of the cathedral. Yes, that's right. So it's going to fill in basically a square that exists there. Originally, I was thinking, well, we're not going to gain that much space. But I stood yesterday looking at the new floor that's been laid, and it's actually a really big space. It's going to be very exciting. So you'd be able to walk in that door, the entrance, and imagine that ahead of you there is a desk to greet you with volunteers and staff to say hello. There'll be an audiovisual screen telling you what's on today in the cathedral. There'll be a great timeline to tell you the story of the cathedral and entice, we hope, you in. There'll be brand new loos for visitors, and that's really important because we've had problems and comments about our loos in the past, and I think they've all been very fair comments. But also, if you can imagine coming in that doorway, you'll be able to turn left towards the refectory, the abbot's kitchen, because the floor in there has been raised, so it'll all be on one level. It'll be a fantastic open space for events, but also to greet our visitors, and also make things so much easier for somebody who might be with a pushchair or a wheelchair or using some other mobility aid. There also is going to be a lift in the chapter house. So young people who want to get up to the classrooms or adults who want to get up to the classrooms on the second and third floor can use the lift. That's never been possible till now.
And if you turn right on going in, you will go into where the books are currently?
Well, where the current bookshop is, that all will come into the new Welcome Centre. So there will be a shop area to the right of the entrance as you come into the Welcome Centre. There'll be a shop area and an information desk and that kind of thing there. You'll be led round through the timeline into the cathedral. We're going to have some good audiovisual displays. I've had the great pleasure of being the internal editor for the text on the timeline, so that's been a real challenge. And then you'll enter into the cathedral through the doors that were always there, and ahead of you will be the great rose window and more information and more discovery.
Really interesting time for St. Albans because, as I said, the museum and gallery having to open this summer, and now this is next summer. I mean,
St. Albans has gone through a step change, let's be honest. In these 2 years, it's really upped the game, and quite rightly so. You know, we are, as you and I know, we're one of England's best kept secrets, St. Albans. Not enough people understand how important and lovely a town and city it is. This is really going to change things. I've got some American friends coming, and I'm really looking forward to showing them the old Georgian Town Hall because it's just beautiful. I mean, the real star of that renovation is the building. It's just fantastic. Mm.
And of course, you talk about secrets. When you start to dig, you find other secrets.
Absolutely, yeah. Just, you know, lay a tennis court and, well, there you go. Yes, of course, we've found all kinds of things. I mean, we knew we were going to find burials because we understood what we were doing. In fact, our original intention was not to disturb any of the burials, but to build the welcome center as a kind of what's called a raft. So it would sit on the ground. But unfortunately, the burials were so close to the surface, we hadn't realized how close to the surface they were.
Those would have been what, recent, from 19th century ones?
Yeah, those were sort of 1750 to 1850. They were only a couple of feet below the surface, so there was no way that we could have sunk foundations without disturbing them. So then, of course, you have to do the quite correct and proper thing, which is to carefully lift them archaeologically, look at them all carefully, study them, because you do learn something about your predecessors in this place. And then they will be reverently reburied in the North Churchyard later on.
And how far did you have to dig down? Were you encouraged to dig down because you kept finding more and more?
Well, the cathedral archaeologists wanted us to look as far as possible because, you know, there is a Roman burial ground under the cathedral, which is what we always say is important to understand, that that is fixes the site of St. Albans' burial very clearly, I think. And we wanted to see how far that Roman burial ground extended. I haven't seen the final report. I don't believe they quite got down to that layer, but they certainly got down to a medieval layer beyond the 19th and 18th century burials that we knew were there.
Just out of interest, when did it cease to be a burial ground? You talked about 1750 to...
About 1850, 1860, thereabouts. It was clearly full by that time. And so post-1860, the burials tend to be on the north side of the cathedral. That's why most of the, if you look at those gravestones on the north, they tend to be late 1800s. The burials are there. Of course, that graveyard itself is now closed. And so it's only a burial for ashes, except for very significant people like bishops. So yes, the actual area we knew had not been used as a cemetery. But what we didn't really understand was what was maybe beneath the 18th and 19th century burials. And that's been some of the more exciting stuff that we've discovered. We've always had this question about where was Abbot John of Wheatamstead, who was abbot in the 1400s, one of the abbots of the 1400s. We knew he'd built a chapel for himself, but the chapel area that the records say were his, we've never really found it. We've never found evidence of a proper chapel there. But there was clearly something very large being uncovered when the archaeologists were doing their work, a much more substantial chapel or room. And it was in the floor of this rather more substantial chapel or room that the burial of Abbot John was uncovered. He was abbot twice, unusually. He was abbot, retired. His successor was abbot for about 10 years and then died. And Abbot John was re-elected in old age to be abbot. We wonder, we don't know, this speculation, did he build himself a second, slightly grander chapel during his second abbacy? And perhaps his original one that we've always said was Abbot John's chantry chapel got used for something else.
Did you find a coffin or is the...
No, the burial was there, so the bones were there. The other substantial thing were these three papal medallions that we can talk about as well. But no, there was no coffin as such. The archaeologists will be able to tell us how that burial had been prepared. I doubt very much that it would have been coffined in the 1400s. He probably would have been shrouded and laid within a tomb, but any material is gone. There was substantially just the bones. There may be other traces, and we're looking forward to reading that report, were there traces of anything else that was there?
And were there other bones of other people, or was that, was it his?
That was the most significant one. Yeah. He was in his own personal chamber. I actually had a chance to see that before it was lifted, and it was amazing. So he was in his own lined chamber. So quite clearly, this was a significant person. And as soon as Professor Clark, who's our advisor, he's Professor of History at Exeter University, who's the expert on John of Wheatamstead, as soon as Professor Clark saw the three papal seals, he was pretty clear who had been buried there.
That's the clue, is it?
That was the real kind of clue. It was roughly in line with where we thought Abbot John might have had a chantry, but these three papal seals and the study of the bones, the age of the person, this was an older man, quite significantly older for those days. This was clearly Abbot John of Wheatamstead.
You just called him Abbot John of Wheatamstead.
It is tricky, isn't it? He comes from Wheatamstead, so he's often called John of Wheatamstead in the way that people were often surnamed by the place they came from. So he's not the Abbot of Wheatamstead. He's Abbot John of Wheatamstead.
Because his family lived in...
His family lived in Wheatamstead. In fact, his parents and his siblings are buried at St. Helen's Church in Wheatamstead. And there's a very firm and clear connection there. He entered the abbey as a boy. He would have been entered by his parents, brought there to study as a monk, as a young man. A very talented young man in many ways. Rose swiftly, and as I say, has become perhaps one of the most famous of our abbots.
And what's the position of an abbot? It's the abbot is in charge of the monastery.
The abbot is in charge of the whole monastery. monastery. So an abbey, and you have to remember St. Albans was England's first abbey. Pope Adrian IV had many centuries earlier given us the title of England's premier abbey. And so the abbot of St. Albans was an exceedingly important person, not just locally, because he governed the abbey and then, in effect, governed St. Albans, but abbots of St. Albans were national figures. They were advisors to the kings. I mean, his really good friends were Henry V, Henry V's brother, Humphrey, who's actually buried at St. Albans. John will have known all of them. He'll have known Edward IV. He'll have known all of their wives, the queens. He moved in important circles.
So he would have been a politician as well as a...
Absolutely. You have to remember, for example, you know, when Parliament in those days met, the abbots of England were part of Parliament. And in fact, there are stories about Abbot John and the Abbot of Westminster, not quite having a tussle about who sat in first rank of amongst the abbots. Because the Abbot of Westminster always believed he was the first abbot of England, and the Abbot of St. Albans always believed he was the first abbot of England, and they often had a little disagreement.
He was such an important person. Is this why he went to Rome? And
all abbots usually went to the Pope to be confirmed in their abbacy. That was quite a common thing. So we know that, you know, for example, Thomas de la Mare in the 1300s went off to Avignon. That's where the papacy was at that point, to be confirmed in his abbacy. So that's what he did towards the beginning of his reign as abbot, which is about 1420. He's elected then. And he goes off to Rome to be confirmed. He actually goes to one of the church councils, the Council of Siena, and he's taken ill. And the Pope sends his personal physician to care for, this is Pope Martin, sends his personal physician to care for Abbot John, and John recovers. And we don't really know the whole details. I mean, someone suggests that he's then going to use the situation to get the most he can out of his visit. You know, I was near death, and oh, Father, could you grant us these special privileges, you know, as a sign of your favour and God's favour to me? And he does. He gets particular privileges for the abbey in terms of how it can manage its income, how it can manage some of its religious feasts. So it's quite an important thing. So
what's the significance of these privileges? Does that mean he can change the practice, or is he going against the law? Or
in effect, it's a dispensation from usual practice. So there would have been common practice about how rents were managed or income was managed, or how perhaps religious services were governed. Papal bulls, and these were called bulls, these documents, these promises from the Pope, in effect gave you freedom from the rules, freedom from the standard conditions that would exist. And so St. Albans was able to use its income more freely than perhaps the standard abbey might. All abbeys received income in different ways. St. Albans had more freedom to be creative about how it used its funding.
We don't really know what difference that made, what sort of things they would have done with the money that they couldn't do before.
Probably they did simple things like have more control over investing it locally. So using it for building locally, or perhaps for relief of the poor in a particular way. We don't have those details, but the monks always remembered Abbot John and honoured him for these three papal bulls. In fact, when they wrote his obituary, they said that he had a threefold character. And I think that's not unusual. They were alluding to these three special promises that he'd extracted from the Pope. These were seen as signs of great honour for somebody being powerful enough to have achieved those things.
So he comes back with these three documents.
He does, these three documents.
And the bull is the seal, is that right?
So what we found in the grave were seals, the kind of seal that would be affixed to the bottom of the document. We're not sure that these are the three original seals. It seems unlikely, but we're not sure that he would have been buried with the originals. He may have had these made as symbols, symbolic copies of the seals. He may have worn these in his lifetime, we don't know, but he clearly wanted to be buried with them as a sign of his great privileges.
Not a seal in the sense that you see the wax and the king or queen stamps their ring on it. It's not that.
Imagine a disc of wax or metallized wax, maybe 3 centimeters or so across. It's like a coin. Imagine a large looking coin. That's what was found. They were so encrusted, it was difficult to read them. They're being cleaned now, and we can see very clearly that they're Pope Martin V, which is the relevant pope.
And so there's text on there.
Only the pope's name and his titles. In fact, he's called the Pastor Pastorum, the Shepherd of the Shepherds. That's one of the titles that the popes used for themselves. These three seals will be, we hope, on display in the new visitor centre and the new exhibition centre next year. We're also hoping, if it's possible, because a substantial amount of the abbot's skull was intact, we're looking at the possibility of a facial reconstruction, a digital facial reconstruction, which would be very exciting to look on the face of the man who did these things. It would be a wonderful thing.
Are his remains going to be put somewhere within the
cathedral? Yes, we'll have to think carefully. I mean, there are all kinds of places we could bury them. If you stand in front of the high altar of the cathedral and look up, there's this glorious roof with lots of gold leaf on it, eagles and lambs. This is Abbot John of Wheatamstead's design. The eagle and the lamb were his personal symbols. Eagle, St. John the Evangelist, lamb, St. John the Baptist. He created that ceiling. He had it beautifully painted to honour his patron saints. Many have said it would be very appropriate to bury him under this great ceiling to recall that. Others have suggested, you know, he was a very good friend of Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. Should his remains be placed within Humphrey's crypt? The only person with a crypt in the building is this royal duke. Because they were good colleagues and friends, might that be a suitable resting place for his bones? They will be reburied with some honour, I think, in the future.
And not in a way that we'll see the bones. These will all be...
No, they will be seen. Yes, I mean, and that will be true for all of the burials. I mean, all the burials in the excavation will be treated with that kind of honour and respect, having studied them and learnt something about particularly the diseases and things that affected people. They'll be reverently reburied and appropriately reburied. That's the way the church treats human remains.
What do you think Abbot John would think about all of this?
I think he'd be ever so pleased we were remembering him. He was somebody who was very proud of his achievements. Somebody once asked Professor Clark, who has, as I say, studied him, would we have liked Abbot John if we'd met him? And Professor Clark is a bit dubious about that, because Abbot John was rather full of himself. I think that would be the way we might describe it today. But I think he would be incredibly pleased to be honoured in that way and to be remembered in that way. You know, I sometimes say when I show people that painted ceiling, you know, Abbot John painted this so he could be remembered. And look, I've just remembered him. He must be really, really pleased about that.
By definition, we talked about him as a very powerful religious leader, and religious leaders were very powerful politically. He was very close to the king and the other members of the royal family at various times. I mean, Henry V is one to have known, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
you suggested he was sort of full of himself. What do we know about him? I mean, who wrote about him? Does he appear in all sorts of history books?
Well, of course, we have a really good record of the abbots in St. Albans, and that's one of the great things about St. Albans Abbey that we have. Although we don't personally possess the documents, there's an incredibly good chronicle of all that the abbots did. So, of course, he's praised and honoured in the chronicles. But there was also a kind of biography written about him after his death. And again, you know, I'm relying on Professor Clark here because I haven't read the original document. But Professor Clark says it's fairly clear that John probably had a significant hand in writing this biography of himself. It's purported to be written by another monk. Professor Clark suggests Abbot John might have written it himself and then, you know, kind of put a ghostwriter's name on top of it. Just to, you know, you can't really write about yourself and praise yourself that much. So somebody else has to praise you. So he puts someone else's name, perhaps, to the biography.
Fascinating. It's going to be very exciting to get into the visiting centre and stuff.
It really will be. I think it'll just be a step change for all of our visitors. I think we really want to tell the story of St. Albans. We want to promote the whole principle, and I've talked about it before with you here, that Alban is Britain's first saint. You know, this is the oldest place of Christian worship. We've got so many exciting stories to tell. We don't want to turn it into a museum. This is a living church, not a museum. But there will be signs around the building to help you interpret what you're seeing. And of course, later on in 2019, the great wall paintings, the four huge figures of the wall paintings, will be illuminated in their original colours. That will be a projection. We just tested the projectors last week, and I wasn't there. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there, but everyone came away from the test just so excited at the possibilities of illuminating these paintings in their original colours, so that people get a sense of just how glorious the medieval church was and why we're told pilgrims entered St. Albans Abbey and dropped to their knees because they thought they were in heaven. The beauty of the building. It'd be nice to just echo some of that.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
You're welcome. Thank you.